I forgot to put my Riesling back in the fridge after yesterday, so I'm drinking room temperature Riesling, which actually tastes surprisingly good. I was like, wait a second, maybe this was meant to be drunk at room temperature because
Like, is it better?
I think I feel like taste more of the flavors. Well, the bottle says to drink it at 54 degrees Fahrenheit, whatever that is. I think my fridge is set to like 40.
But
So,
your room is set to like 98.
yeah, well, it's definitely not 54.
All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Bottomless Broadway, where we talk musicals over mimosas. Even though there's like 5.5 million new musicals this 2024 season to talk through, we're still going to kick off with a preseason off-Broadway highlights episode. I've been like calling it Roundup, but then I'm like, it's really not because it's two shows, and that would just be offensive because there's like 2,000 shows off Broadway. So yeah, I'm going with off-Broadway highlights. We're covering two really good shows. I think we're both fans of them.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So we're going to be starting with Here We Are, the new and final Sondheim premiered show, and Classic Stages, I Can Get It For You Wholesale, which is a revival.
So, because this is going to be, I guess, a slightly different episode, we probably won't go as much in depth as we do for a normal episode. It'll just be, I guess, more broad strokes. We will talk about the plot a bit for both. This is a pretty loosely formatted episode, so we'll kind of just see where we go.
We're going to start with Here We Are.
Yeah. Just so people know, like, there definitely will be spoilers for Here We Are because I think it's kind of impossible to talk about the show without spoiling something because it is pretty wild.
Even though I just saw this, like my recollection of it is so foggy because I just feel like it's such a trip.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm gonna do my best with the summary. Well, first, it's based on two separate foreign films about rich people, Sondheim's favorite topic. Oh, also it's playing at the Shed, which was cool to go to. When is it playing to? Is it gonna still be playing
It's
in
like
January?
middle to end of January.
Okay, so probably still playing when this comes out, likely, but
Yeah.
almost not. Cool. So Act One is inspired by a movie called The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, which introduces our characters, two rich people, Leo and Marianne Brink, and then two slightly less rich people, Claudia and Paul Zimmer, and then one ambassador, Raphael.
Yeah.
Santelli de Santiago. And then Marianne's like hipster communist sister, Fritz. And all of them gather at Leo and Marianne Brink's house for brunch, only to find that like the Brinks have no recollection of this brunch. So then they hit the streets in search of food, and they hit up like, you know, some of the trendiest, most exclusive, most expensive restaurants. But all of these places like don't really live up to the hype. Something weird happens at each of them, whether like it's no food or no diners or dead people. And it starts like feeling a little bit not eerie, but just kind of like alternate universe-y. Like, this no longer feels like reality slowly. Throughout all this time, Fritz, the hipster sister, is talking to some mysterious but also very sketchy person on the phone, planning an apocalypse type thing to take down the rich.
Yeah.
And it also becomes evident that the men in the show are running a drug ring. At some point, they run into like the military who are searching for people running a drug ring. But instead of arresting everyone, the soldier falls in love with Fritz. And then they all end up going to the ambassador's house because there's no fucking food anywhere. And then it's revealed that the ambassador's butler is the sketchy person on the phone planning the apocalypse with Fritz, which freaks her out. And then mysteriously after dinner, for no reason that like the audience can see, the Brinks and the Zimmers are unable to leave. They like will not step out of the ambassador's residence. It
Well,
just
to be
freaks them
fair,
the
it's
fuck
like everyone, not just them.
out. Okay. So then after they realize they can't leave, they decide to have a sleepover. Like they're all kind of like chill about it. They're like, yeah, let's just have a sleepover at the ambassador's house. And the ambassador is like, I didn't invite you, but whatever. And then in the middle of the night, Marianne has a crazy dream where like a bear shows up. And then sometime in the middle of the night, the grand piano at the ambassador's place no longer has music. And so there's no more songs in the show. And they wake up to find out that like all of the staff except for the butler is gone. And there's basically no food except like what was left over on the bar cart last night. So then it kind of becomes like a little bit Lord of the Flies-y. Leo Brink gets sick and dies.
And then comes back to life.
Comes back to life. Yeah, eventually they do make it out okay, which like we can probably just talk about.
What were your first impressions of the show after it ended?
I loved the show, but not really for reasons I was expecting to, because like I really like Sondheim style music, and you do get that in this show, but I wouldn't say it's a particularly like memorable song list.
Yeah,
you know, like every Sondheim show has like a couple of songs that just really make it, and I don't really know what that would be in this show. But I thought like the characters were really charming. The performances were really good. Obviously, like the cast is extremely star-studded right now, and I don't know if it'll ever be like that again. I really appreciate how it's this like absurdism. Things don't make sense, but if you just like accept the universe that they're in, there is a real plot that's interesting, and it's not just like bullshit all the time.
Yeah.
Because I was saying to you about how it reminded me of Bottoms, if anyone's seen that movie. Like, weirdly, it seems like so of its time, despite the fact that Sondheim probably started working on it a long time ago, and he's super old and, you know, passed away now. Because it actually just feels like really modern. And yeah, I feel like that's shocking to me because it was based on these old movies and, you know, written by an older person.
Yeah.
I've really been noticing in the last, I feel like not even decade, maybe like 5 years or so. I feel like maybe it's just because of Marvel and like this multiverse concept. But I feel like ever since they've been doing the multiverse concept, a lot of indie films and stuff have also kind of been exploring this like parallel universe idea. I don't know if you felt that way, but it's like I feel like they opened the floodgates to it, and then there's just like a lot of mention of that now.
I wouldn't have related this to that, because this to me feels, it's a little bit like they exist in not a parallel universe, but like an empty universe almost. It's like definitely a used convention where it's kind of just like the universe doesn't exist outside of where they currently are. And
yeah,
like things only happen when they need them to happen. And you don't really know what the world outside of their view is.
I'm not saying that like it reminds me of like the Marvel multiverse, but I just feel like ever since that became a big thing, the idea of like alternate realities has just been a trend and been more present in pop culture.
Yeah.
And so, like, yeah, when I was watching Bottoms, it's just, like, it kind of starts, like, here we are, where it's, like, things seem normal. You know, they show up at a friend's house for brunch. Bottoms is, like, two girls go to high school. But then it starts getting more and more crazy that you're just kind of, like, oh, they're not in my reality. They're, like, in a similar one, but it's not this one. And I just feel like, for that reason, it feels
modern.
Yeah, like it feels very like now.
So I was a little concerned when people said that this was going to be like absurdist, surrealist, but I actually found it very easy to follow on the surface level. But my friend actually brought up, I think the show itself is actually very similar to Triangle of Sadness. Kind of spoilers for that show. It's about a bunch of people on a like rich person yacht and sort of the power struggle between the rich people and the people working the yacht, and then the yacht gets shipwrecked and then they're all on an island and have to survive, and then the poor people kind of are able to take a bit more power because the rich people don't know how to survive without all their luxuries. And we do have two other characters. They're just called man and woman in the cast list, but they play basically a variety of servants. And one of them, later we find out, is the actual mastermind behind the revolution that's supposed to like destroy the world or something. And he is actually the one holding everyone literally at gunpoint in the room in the second act. And he is taking control of all the the food and everything. I forget what his name was, because he has like a code name, but it's Inferno. So I did want to talk about, like, I guess some character arcs specifically. I think the easiest one to start with is Fritz and kind of Inferno and the whole revolution plot line, because I feel like that is probably the most straightforward to me. And I guess just like a quick summary of Fritz. So she is this, like you said, communist revolutionist who is sisters with Marianne. She's like in this place where she despises the rich, or at least like makes it seem like it. But then Leo points out in the second act, like, oh, well, you're happy to have, you know, these really fancy dinners with us every month. And like, we've taken so much care of you and you're just complaining about us, but you're not actually doing anything against it. Well, or like, you're like a socialist who's still getting fed by the hand of the rich directly. Yeah. And stuff. And I thought that was like a really cool character. It's like not like it's a character we've never seen before, but I think we don't see it a ton still.
She's like a Rory Gilmore. And honestly, like, I for a long time assumed that Fritz was their daughter and not Marianne's sister, because the way that Michaela Diamond plays her, she just seems like such a privileged child. Because even though she's like screaming about this revolution the whole time, there's nothing she does that really makes you feel like she's one of the people.
Yeah.
She's dressed alternatively, but still in nice clothes. She asks Leo Brink for $50 million to sponsor the revolution, and like threatens that he'll reveal his drug ring otherwise.
Yeah.
Which is just like, that in itself is absurd. Like, it's just so not conscientious that I just thought she was their daughter. I was just like, what kind of adult human being asks someone for $50 million to like take down the rich? Like, it just, you know, like, it's so, it makes so little sense that I just assumed she was like a spoiled little teenager the whole time.
One of the things where you first realize this is in that cafe, everything, and everyone's like trying to decide what to get. And they're having trouble figuring out what to get. And, you know, they're sort of like, it's that thing where you, the waiter comes and you're like, oh, wait, shit, like, come back to me. I'm not ready. And she's ready. But she has one of those ridiculously complicated orders where she has like, you know, five different substitutions. And she's like kind of a brat about it. Like you said, with her being kind of like a child, it, the way that it's played is, I didn't actually believe there was a true revolution that was like gonna be happening, because I thought she was just saying vague things like, one day the people will be in power and you won't, and like, take that.
I thought she was getting scammed. Yeah. Like, I thought she was a stupid rich teenager and someone was scamming her for $50 million and nothing was gonna happen and she was just gonna get scammed to $50 million.
Yeah. I think the part of her that does a little bit confuse me is the love story, because she sees a soldier. She has said she's gay since she was like three, and the soldier is a guy, and she like falls in love at first sight. They have this whole thing. They have sex in a closet. And like, I just don't really know what that's supposed to signify. Like, I don't know if it's just like, oh, well, you think you know yourself until you fall in love, or like, oh, she was just trying to be edgy by saying she was gay or something like that. Like, I'm not really sure what that's supposed to be, if you have any thoughts.
I kind of thought it was the she was trying to be edgy part. And I feel like she might also like women, but she just like tries so hard to like reject mainstream. But then if it really appeals to her, like the fancy dinners or an extremely hot soldier, she'll just be like, fuck it.
Yeah. So it just kind of like her convictions aren't as strong as she thinks they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I actually really thought her ending was cool, because the way that it ends, they like finally leave the room. Inferno actually disappears, which is very cool, because it's just like, oh, is he off to start a revolution somewhere else? Who knows? And you do kind of hear the bombs and fire and stuff in the background as they're leaving the room, and as they're sort of, they give like ending monologues, direct address to the audience, basically. But I thought hers was most interesting. Hers is very Gen Z, actually. because you know how like Gen Z is very much like, oh, I don't know if we'll live long enough to see the world not collapse and to be able to have children and like all that. But it also felt like she was using the revolution as an excuse to like not have to live a real adult life and like be part of this society that we're in. Like it was her rebellion, but it was kind of her rebellion that went too far, because she did sort of regret having a role in the revolution at some point, mostly after she was with the soldier and had better things to worry about.
Yeah, I definitely feel like there was a point in my life where I was just like, I don't love anyone that much. I'm not that close to my family. Like, I want to do dumb shit. Like, I want to, like, if I could, I would go skydiving every day. I would do like dangerous things constantly. If someone was like, if you could die to save 500 people, I'd probably be like, yes, absolutely. Now that I'm not like that anymore, I am just kind of like, yeah, I do value my own life more. So yeah. I feel like she makes sense.
Yeah. And that's why I sort of like, I think she is the one that, again, is the most straightforward to me to understand. I think she does also come out of the room with like a new respect for Leo, because he technically, he was sort of a self-made millionaire, and maybe he made that on the backs of other people and like did a lot of shady shit to get there.
Drugs.
But, and like murder. But he did technically make this life for himself. I think she's realizing that. And you sort of see this with a lot of liberals, I think, especially our age, where people are liberal, but you can tell some of them are maybe just liberal because that's the quote unquote right thing to do in terms of like everyone else is doing it, you know, like they don't truly believe in it in the same way that a lot of other people do. And I feel like that's kind of, she like made that into her identity, where she was like, oh, well, fuck the rich people because I'm trying to like relate to the working class or whatever, even though I don't think she has a job. Like, I don't think she is the working class, you know? So it was just like she needed an identity and she didn't know how to find that. So she just fell back on the revolution as like an excuse. And it was kind of like, the world ends tomorrow, like I'll have done my job for the people.
It's giving, I'm getting my fifth degree because I don't want to enter the workforce.
Pretty much. I was listening to an interview with Dennis O'Hare, who plays Inferno, and he was talking about how literally Leo Brink is like always the top dog. He's always the highest position. Even when he's dead for a hot second, he's like covered in a tapestry. It's very, what's the word? Like majestic and stuff. And like, so Inferno sort of represents the actual working class because he was the ambassador's butler, and was just like catering to the ambassador's every whim and stuff. And then he finally saw a situation where he wouldn't have to do that. And I think he, you know, truly believed in the revolution and wanted to be able to just break out of his working class bounds. And actually, he had like a true vendetta against the rich and wanted them to suffer because he had been suffering his whole life by working for them, essentially.
The other thing that I found kind of interesting there is like, we don't really know what the revolution entails, because it's hard to imagine like a revolution where there's bombs going off everywhere in major cities, but it benefits the poor people and is just like only hurting mm-hmm. the rich, or like how that's actually supposed to like implement a new world order where the working class are no longer suffering. So I don't know if that's just generally alluding to like, it's a very hard thing to do, but yeah, like they never really talk about how the revolution is actually supposed to help the working class.
I think it's also meant to be more like, things aren't good for me right now, so I'd rather see the world burn. And like, if I burn with it, so be it. But I'd rather see these people suffer than actually try to make a better life for other people like me, you know?
Yeah. Inferno's very like mass shooter, like not.
Yeah.
You mentioned like they finally leave the room, there's bombs going off, they give kind of like a little ending speech. It's very weird as well. Like it also kind of feels to me like the bombs are next to them, but not around them, kind of, because for a hot second you see them like running around panicked kind of and like dodging stuff or whatever. So it feels like there's bombs. But then when they give their ending speech, it doesn't really seem like they've acknowledged that a revolution and all those like apocalyptic noises are happening. They're not like, oh, given this like revolution, how will I go about my life? They just continue. They talk about what they learned in the room and how they're going to like bring that into their daily lives, assuming like their lives were the same that they were before. So it's almost, I don't know, like it felt like the bombing stuff was like part of that room, like the experience of the room. And then it's like they leave the room and then they leave the front yard of bombs. And then now they're back in their happy place again.
Yeah, I agree. So pivot to Marianne now. She is the wife. I just love the way that Rachel Bay Jones plays her because she seems like such a ditz and so like head in the clouds, lost in her own world. But at the same time, she just really feels like so grounded, especially in Act Two. Like she is sort of in her own world, but she also feels like almost the most real character for me in some ways.
I remember liking her, but I kind of don't remember why anymore. So you should just continue.
She spends the whole show in this like light blue negligee. You pointed out at the end, she's the only one that gets to like keep her costume basically because everyone else like walks out of this room as if they've walked out of a war zone with only like bits of their original outfit left. And she has her entire outfit together. It's great. She's like one of those upper class white wives that is well-meaning, but just kind of out of touch with the world. But I think it's just like she does have a sort of depth to her that I don't think a lot of the other characters have. And I mean, the main scene of this show that everyone talks about is her conversation with the bishop. And this is in Act Two. There's a bishop played by David Hyde Pierce who is looking for a new job because, I mean, all the reviews are like, because what role does religion have in today's society? Which, fair. So they're just like trying to pass the time. They're out of food. So she's literally eating pieces of paper out of a book.
Like I always say, I really like Joey from Friends, which is why I named my dog after him, because I feel like he is a womanizer, but he has so much childhood innocence that you just kind of like him. At one point, he comes home and people are eating pie off the floor and he's like, okay, this is where we're at now. Let's eat from the floor. And it's just very like that. She's just like, okay, I'm having a great conversation. I'm going to enjoy some paper. She's rich, but she's like, I'm not too good to eat paper.
Yeah. Yeah. She might be out of touch with the rest of the world, but I think she understands the realities of where she is very well. She does have a song in the beginning of Act Two because they're in this like beautiful, I think it's a drawing room or something. And she's like, oh my God, I love it here. Wouldn't it be great to just live here? Like, I mean, ha ha for later. But she has some lyric that I can't remember the exact words, but something like, I like things that gleam. I like the way that they seem. Why do things have to be the way that they are and not the way that they seem? There's a more clever rhyme in there than what I can recall. But yeah, she's like, I know that all of this image is superficial, but I like that image, and what's wrong with liking that for the sake of liking that, even if I know that it's fake. The conversation with the bishop is she's just like, oh, it's kind of fun. Just like we're staying up at night. Like, let's talk about the meaning of life. And they do kind of have a conversation about that. And that is a little bit where I think the title of the show comes from. It's just sort of like life is just we're here. We do the things that we need to do to like get through things. And David Hyde Pierce has this really great line about, so she says something about, oh, it's just living to be continued because we don't know what's coming next. And he's like, yeah, life is to be continued. And you're just being essentially in the moment. And I think that is part of the themes of this whole show, making sure you live in the moment and you sort of appreciate the things that are there. And, you know, we talked about how Fritz is sort of avoiding real life and stuff, and that is part of it. And I think maybe throughout the show, Marianne is the one that truly appreciates things. There's this one sort of recurring song that's probably called something like Perfect Day, where she's like, oh my God, this day is perfect. Won't you buy this day for me? I want this day to stay. And I think part of her lesson is also just learning to appreciate things in the moment, because not everything can stay that way.
What's the deal with her and the bear?
I don't know. So this bear comes out, she dances with a bear, and then it's unclear if it's a dream or not. I think there's a bear in the movie. I don't know if it had any more significance in the movie. I think it's also just part of the whole appreciate things in the moment, because she literally tells herself, like, remember this when you wake up later. And then she does not remember it later. And I think it's just one of those things where it's like, oh, it's so weird. You would think she would remember that. But at the same time, it's also like, oh, that's so weird. Of course it was a dream. But because we're in this surrealist world, it's like, well, is it a dream? Like, unclear. So I think it's also just putting the audience's perspective into question. You know, the whole Harry Potter quote of like, just because it's in your head, that doesn't mean it's not real. That sort of thing. This is what I mean when I'm like, I think there's something really profound here, but I haven't quite mined the depths of the show enough to really touch upon what it's quite getting at. Like, I feel like I can see a vague shape of it, but I don't really know what it is. And like, maybe that's part of the show. And maybe that's just like, you know, what makes it a really interesting show to talk about and think about. And yeah. Did you have anything else to say about this?
Oh, I did want to say, at the end of the show, obviously we've said that they make it out of the room, but the way they make it out of the room also like makes no sense. They decide on a whim to reenact their scene that very first night when they arrived at the ambassador's residence, mm-hmm. like when they like said their goodbyes and were preparing to leave, but then they didn't leave. So they decided to reenact that scene, and they thought it would put everything back into place. So they do it the first time, but Leo Brink is dead. So I feel like we keep saying he's dead, but it's just like, it sounds so crazy. But yeah, he has like heartburn or something, and then he just dies. They do it and it doesn't completely work because he doesn't say his line, but then all of a sudden he comes back to life, and then they say everything, including his line, and they're all of a sudden able to leave again. And mm-hmm. so like the first thing I said about this scene to you after we saw it was, I think the butler slash Inferno also said something, because like he was also there that night. You
right.
know? So I thought that it would be like what they were missing was the working man's voice, like something from like the butler or the maid or whatever. And then when they remembered that, then they would be let out. But yeah, like I thought that was going to be the message, but I guess that's probably like too straightforward for what they were going for. It being at the shed, I feel like fits very well, because the shed has this like hyper modern minimalistic aesthetic to it anyway. And so how bare the stage is, just, I just feel like it fits the whole aesthetic. But I also told you it wasn't what I was expecting, because I generally just like think of Sondheim characters and shows as like being set in the 80s with like nice furniture and stuff. And we did say like the rich people felt like they were kind of dated. And I feel like their outfits, they're modern, but they're not the most modern. Like they definitely could be rich people from 10, 20 years ago, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's just weird. Like there are no set pieces to clue you in, not only as to what country or city they're in, but also what time period they're in. And so that whole thing just kind of like suspends this make-believe world. And I guess you're just supposed to like imagine what's around them the entire time, because it just like keeps changing because you don't really know what it's supposed to be.
Yeah, which is why I'm also interested in like future productions and stuff, and how it could relate to different time periods and things like that. But mm-hmm. I don't really think it's necessarily a show that would work that well on Broadway. It's almost like too intellectual for Broadway. Not to disparage Broadway audiences, but I mean, yeah. So I don't really think it would necessarily work that well on Broadway. But I think it would be a shame if it was like never to show up again somewhere else. And I think it would be really interesting to see different interpretations of it down the line, like, you know, how people are now reinventing a lot of old shows. Like, I think this could be really cool with different directors. And of course, like, it might not have the same meaning, but that's also part of what would be cool about it, is just how many different meanings you could get from it as well.
I couldn't be more sorry, madam. But sad to say, the fact is that not only do we have no soy.
Oh boy.
Don't tell me that you
have
no
mocha.
Then just a decaf latte.
We're also out of lattes. What? We do expect a little latte later, but we haven't got the latte latte now.
You can't be out of latte. That would mean you're out of milk.
Sir, not only are we out of milk, we're out of cream, we're out of half and half.
Cafe latte without
we're
the lot.
We're also out of calf.
Not even D.
Is that a laugh?
All right, then T. Twining's Earl Grey, bag on the side.
Ah, yes. Well,
don't tell me.
I am so sorry.
The other show that we wanted to talk about was the classic stage revival of I Can Get It For You Wholesale. This is a show that was originally written by Jerome Wideman, John Wideman, his son, who is also known for working with Sondheim. Basically made some changes to it, added
really?
Some book
what did,
scenes.
What did he work on with Sondheim?
Oh, he was the one that did Pacific Overtures, Assassins, and Roadshow. So that can be our like sort of tie-in for this episode between the two shows. But yeah, so he like went back to the original novel and pulled in some cut songs from the show that existed before and basically remounted it with the classic stage folks. Got a great cast. Like Santino Fontana is playing the main character of Harry Bogan. But yeah, I guess you want to jump into a summary?
Yes, like you said, it's a revival of a musical from the 60s. Main character is Harry Bogan. He like starts off as a young boy to a single mother, down on his luck, working for pennies in New York City's garment district. And he's Jewish, which is important. And then he kind of at the end of the show ends up being a semi-successful and very much dishonest swindling businessman. And so the show kicks off with a strike. They're on strike because like they want a wage increase. It's like a tiny wage increase, like 50 cents or something, right? And Harry Bogan is just like, 50 cents is not going to do fuck all for me and my mom. So he decides to basically like economies of scale, whatever, and create his own like delivery business that then sends delivery men to all of the individual clothing companies. But anyways, he starts this business with his friend, and then he sort of lies his way into selling his half of the business to his friend so that he has seed money to start a better, bigger company, a clothing company with two like garment district big names, a really good salesperson and a really good designer. But he kind of ends up a rich asshole and spending a lot of money on women and swindling his business partners out of their money and then going to court and framing other people. And in this show, at the end, he kind of still ends up on top. But in the original musical in the 60s, they kind of give him a happy ending of like being forgiven by the people who care about him in the show, because that's kind of a golden age ending. But yeah, I was literally reading like the guide on Classic Stage's website, and they were like, yeah, we were able to like change this ending because audiences in the 60s were really not comfortable with like an anti-hero or a protagonist making shitty decisions, but now we're very comfortable with that kind of character. I'm like, oh, wonderful, thank you.
I saw the show twice. I really enjoyed it. I was honestly surprised. I saw it mostly for the cast and because I've liked a lot of what Classic Stage does. And so I had no expectations going in. I think I knew zero songs. And like, I actually really liked the songs too, which are by Harold Rome. And I think the rewrites like really made it work for me because they added this sort of framing device of Harry telling the story to the audience. Harry's played by Santino Fontana, and who's also very charming, so that helps. And all those like direct audience addresses are from the book mostly because the book is written in first person, but they didn't have those originally in the show. And it sort of lets him acknowledge that he is kind of being a bad person in regards to his friends and his business partners and stuff. But it's also sort of like a oh, well, like, you know, see it from my side. I had to do what I had to do kind of thing. And like, whether you agree with him or not, it is still like a, you understand the type of person he is, which I thought was really important to the show, even if you don't like him.
I feel like you like him more than I do. I find him a charismatic person, but like, I'm not as into him that like, it really made me like his character that much more. I do feel like he was reasonable in the beginning. He's like, you know what? I did ask out like my high school crush, but then this fucking Broadway diva like rubbed her naked inner thigh on me. So what do you expect me to do? I'm like, you know what? Fair enough, right? It's not like he went out there looking to cheat. Something crazy happened to him. Okay. I'm like, sure, fair. But then it just like starts like getting more and more inexcusable where he's just like, I put my friend in jail. What did you expect me to do? I'm like, that's not gonna, you can't just like talk charismatically and expect me to.
I agree with that. Like, you know, like that definitely was kind of a like last straw moment. Like, I'm not defending that at all.
It's honestly, it's funny because like we just reviewed Here Lies Love, which is actually going to come out after this episode. But I was literally like, I just don't like Imelda that much because she doesn't have any special ambition. And she literally gets a little taste of money, like a little taste of beauty and loses her mind. And that's kind of what Harry Bogan is too. It's like in the beginning, I was very much on his side because I'm like, he grew up in poverty. He's trying to like make it for him and his mom. And like the first time he makes money, he literally like showers his mom with gifts. Like he seems like a relatively good guy. And so maybe he does like a couple like iffy business deals to get there, like fine, reasonable character, you know? Mm-hmm. But then it's like slowly, I just feel like that part of his character deteriorates so much and it doesn't really seem like he has ambition. He's just like, I swindled people out of a ton of money. I'm going to spend all of it on my mistress and not even really think about the future in terms of 3 years down the line. And he just becomes an idiot. So I no longer like him because he doesn't have a defining characteristic.
Yeah.
I literally would have rathered him frame his friend and put him in jail so that he could own the entire company. Or something that feels more evil mastermindy than I was thinking with my dick.
Yeah. Understandable. Yeah. The thing about this show that really works for me, we do sort of get his side and stuff, but I don't think it tries to make an excuse for him. And a lot of people had mentioned this show being like, oh, well, isn't this sort of playing into Jewish stereotypes about money and business? And also this show deals with a lot of how Jews were discriminated against in that era and how they kind of could only work in the garment district and couldn't really pursue other fields of work.
Did you see that thing in the show guide about how the garment district formed?
Because basically they got exiled from everywhere else or something like that.
Yeah, it was like the Fifth Ave Association formed because they felt like they were threatened by like immigrant workers. So they basically were like limiting the kinds of businesses that could open up, I think like first on Fifth Ave and then kind of all over the trendier neighborhoods. So they basically squeezed all the Jewish people into what today is the garment district.
Yeah. But yeah, I was going to say, but I think what this show does really well is it does have a lot of like Jewish culture in it, just in the way that he interacts with his mom and him and his mom interact with his business partners who are also all Jewish and how they sort of become a family unit, almost like an extended family. And in the end, the way that they play it is he is like, yeah, so I'm the villain. So what? Like, I'm going to just keep looking for ways to land on my feet. I don't really care about who gets hurt, you know? And then you see kind of like a time skip where his friend who was sentenced to jail is finally getting out of jail. He's like finally sitting down to dinner with his family for the first time. And Harry's mom is there. His other former business partner is there. Basically, like everyone is sitting down to dinner together and breaking bread together without him. And he is standing alone. And it's sort of like a he's in the bed that he made. And that's the life that he chose. And that's the life away from his culture and his family and everything. And I thought that was a really smart way to end it, to just, you know, delineate what kind of life Harry's chosen and what kind of life he could have had, essentially, if he were, you know, smarter.
For like a hot second there, he had a great business plan.
Yeah. Right?
Like
his business was doing well.
Exactly. Like, it wasn't like it was a bad business. He just, like, he could be so rich if he just waited like a decade. Yeah. Maybe not even. But he was just like, no, I have to blow $1 million on my mistress now.
Yeah.
What a business. What a sap game. It's about as much a business as a crap game. Snap a zipper, go our button. All we know is all the experts know from nothing. So the last line you got by with, coming right up is another you could die with. If you're right, the dough could flow in. If you're not, you haven't got a pot to sew in.
But also, so I want to talk about his old boss.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. At the very start of the show, when, you know, he's on strike, his boss, who is the owner of a really big clothing factory in the garment district.
Pulvermacher is the boss.
At the beginning, you meet him as like the factory owner and everyone's on strike. And he's kind of very like iron-fisted. He's like, all right, I'll buy into your delivery business, but you need to have it ready in like 2 hours. And then you don't really hear from him that much anymore. And he just seems kind of a straight-laced businessman, like doing garment business the old-fashioned way. And meanwhile, like the new company that Harry Bogan starts is kind of trying new things, I guess. And I just thought like, that's what he represented. We're done with him. But then at the very end, when Harry's business like goes down in flames, they're in and out of court with his designer, Bushkin, Meyer Bushkin. Yeah. And things aren't looking good for him, right? Like even when he does end up framing his friend, it is still like he owned a business that went down. And Pulvermacher comes over and he's like, none of my kids want to take over my business, so why don't you take it over? And then he like has a little song or something where he's just like, is it a song or is it just a monologue?
It's just a monologue.
Oh, my bad. But yeah, he's just like, when I was little, my dad was like, there's exactly three jobs a Jewish man can do. So I chose clothing and I stuck with it my entire life. Yep, that's my life. it's just like, it's so out of nowhere. And I guess it's supposed to be like he offers Harry Bogan this job because he sees Harry Bogan as this like ambitious upstarter type person who like started the delivery business and then used that to see to fund a bigger business. And I feel like he respects Harry, and I think like that kind of more plays into this anti-hero thing where it's like he did these bad things, but people recognize him for having like a good mind for business, and he's just going to keep utilizing that to his advantage. But I feel like that's also why the fact that he just ended up not being that good at business really bothers me.
Right. Yeah, I guess it is sort of like a the rich will find ways to land on their feet, because he sort of had that connection. Not that it really showed up through the story, but he was ruthless enough that he got the respect of Pulvermacher. So Harry is still finding a way to just like continue on, even though he literally has nothing except what's been handed to him in the last 5 minutes. I do agree that him not being that smart about business is a little bit of an issue, because it's kind of just like, oh, well, is he just going to run this business to the ground, also buying things for other women? Or like, what's,
yeah,
is that just how his life goes? And he does do sort of a monologue at the end where he's like, oh, like, you know, I'm still the bad guy. I never got my lesson, which I thought was like a good monologue for the story to end on, because it is kind of just like a, oh, embrace the anti-hero. And he sings like a really angry reprise of a lot of the songs that they've been singing through the show. And I guess part of it is maybe just like he is sort of feeling the injustice of what discrimination Jews felt. But again, if he were a better businessman, like he could have done a lot better a lot of other things. He has this fatal flaw. He's going to keep running things into the ground, but he's going to keep getting lucky breaks, I guess. And he is like scrappy, to be fair. Like he does have some sense of like in the beginning when he tricked his friend into selling his half of the company, and when he decided to like undercut the people who were striking, you know, he sold out his friend. So he technically, I guess, gets to keep his reputation.
I'm not sure if, like, we should say he's scrappy. I just feel like he has no morals.
You're the catcher or the pitcher. You're bamboozled or you get richer. You get done to or you do it. That's the way things are. You're the loser or the winner. You're the diner or you're the dinner. You get screwed up or you screw it. That's the way things are. That's the way things are, and they've always been. If you're on the cold outside and you're wanting in, you gotta climb higher, always climb. To hell with the rules, get used to the fools who have to be stepped on from time to time.
His other business partner, Teddy Ash, like, was smart and got bought out of his share. And so he was smart, but he's kind of the only one going around telling people, like, yo, this guy's shady, because I guess Harry managed to pin all the blame on Meyer.
He's also sketchy as fuck, because immediately after he gets, so, like, he, you know, goes to Meyer and Harry. He's like, something's wrong on the books. Harry, like, freaks out and basically agrees to buy out Teddy, because he knows that Teddy knows the truth. He doesn't want Meyer to listen to Teddy. So he buys him out. And at this point, you know, he's already been, like, money laundering or something for a while, but then they spend a ton of money buying out a third of the partnership. So now he has, like, no money. And so his checks to his Broadway diva mistress start bouncing. And immediately Teddy shows up at her doorstep and is like, you know what? Harry has no money now. How about you start sleeping with me? And I was like, what the fuck is the point of that scene? Because up until then, I kind of assumed, like, Teddy was a better guy. It's such a weird way to end his arc. It would have been better if his whole thing was, like, going around talking shit about Harry, but his arc literally just ends with him, like, trying to seduce Harry's old mistress.
Yeah. So based on the summary that I read from, like, MTI or whoever licenses this show, I think originally that scene was the mistress was realizing the checks bounced and that he got bought out, so then he had money, so the mistress was the one that made her move on him. And I wonder if they changed that just to make her seem less like a
whore.
yeah exactly. So I wonder if they did that for that reason. But if you actually listen to the song as it shows up on the original cast album, this is the song What's In It For Me, I think it makes a lot more sense like that. And I can't remember, like, I didn't know the songs well enough to know if they changed lyrics to it to make it make more sense. The mistress, her name's Martha Mills. She is sort of shown to be kind of a gold digger, like, at least has ambitions, like, knows how the game is played. She, like, entered this relationship with Harry knowing fully well that he had, like, a true girlfriend. And they sing a song when they first meet about how much they both love money. So, you know, that really sets you up for her character there.
I really like the song that she shares with Harry's actual girlfriend. Whose name is
Ruthie.
Grab Them While I Can and Love Is Not Enough. Is that what it is?
So Martha sings Grab Them While I Can and Ruthie sings Love Is Not Enough. And it's near the beginning of Act Two when they both realize that Harry is just not gonna be, like, endgame for either of them. I think these are both formerly cut songs because they're not on the cast album.
Ruthie and Harry never get married, right?
No, because then she marries her boss.
Yeah. Oh my god, I forgot about that. I really was so happy for her because I forgot that women used to just be able to go out and find a husband in 10 minutes. Because it does also, like, happen on Mad Men multiple times. Usually, you know, that's terrible for women. But in her case, I was like, you go, girl. You find a husband in 10 minutes and you show him.
Yeah. But yeah, the two songs that they sing together, I do really like. Because in the first act, it ends with you think that Harry's going to take Ruthie on a date. They got tickets to the Met or something. And then Martha is giving him the keys to her apartment to be like, I'll meet you there. And Harry cancels the date with Ruthie. And so you're already like, oh no, he's just going to be stringing her along while he's fucking this other famous Broadway star. And so the fact that that song came fairly early in Act Two of just like, love is not enough, this isn't going to end the way that I want this to end, I thought was smart for like a modern audience, because then we didn't have to feel too bad for her the whole time, you know? I was happy that happened.
Like, Ruthie's not an idiot, which was great. And also in regards to Ruthie, like, I think Harry feels bad. He has no morals, but I feel like that's not entirely true, because I think he wants Ruthie because it seems like he's had a crush on her, like, through his youth. She's like a super respectable girl, so it'd be like great to have her by his side, like, for business purposes. And I think he like does in some kind of way like want endgame with Ruthie, but then at the same time he knows that like he's not really gonna be able to give her what she deserves. So at one point when he needs money to start his business and he's about to go like semi-scam his first friend that he opened the delivery business with, Ruthie offers him the money. She's like, I have it. And he's like, oh, I can't take your money. It's a bit of like alarm bells to her, because it is kind of like, well, if he wants to spend the rest of his life with me the way that he says he does, like, why wouldn't he just take the money? Because like, we're a family, you know? Mm-hmm. So I feel like it is kind of alarm bells for her. Like, she sort of understands something, but it is also like, oh, good on him for not doing that.
I was pleasantly surprised at that too, because you literally hear the whole audience like gasp when she offers him the money. Like, everyone is like, do not do this. And he actually turns it down, which was a surprise, because he is already at this point portrayed as being fairly ruthless in, you know, like getting what he wants. So it's like, oh, he is kind of a decent human being, even if some of his business practices are sketchy. And then, of course, he goes right on to like trick his friend out of half the company.
But, I also want to talk about that and clarify it, because so basically the part when he tricks his friend or gets his friend to buy his half of his the first delivery business is also the first time that he meets Martha Mills, right? And it's super weird because they basically talk about how last night when she was on stage performing at her show, he saw him and he's like the cutest person in the first 8 rows of the orchestra or whatever, which is the only place worth sitting. But anyways, the thing I actually wanted to talk about is, so she meets him at this like club the next day after she gets security to send him a note when she sees him at the show. And he, for some reason, schedules his meeting with his friend who he opened the delivery business with at the same time and same place. So he literally makes Martha watch him scam his friend. He literally is like, dude, my health is so bad. I just can't work anymore. I need you to buy my half of the business. It's such a bad deal for me. And I love our business and it has so much potential, but I'll take like $8 million for it or like whatever it is. And the friend is like, yeah, man, no problem. So sorry about your health, you know? And then he makes Martha watch that. And then Martha is like, so I'm guessing the business isn't worth that much and you scammed him. And he's like, he's like, I'm not saying it wasn't worth that much. I'm just saying the money is worth more to me if I put it elsewhere, or like some shit like that.
Right.
Which, I mean, I think actually makes sense, but it's still a dickhead thing to say in general. So yeah, he like literally makes her watch that interaction, which is also like a little bit sinister.
Yeah. I wonder if she had maybe a reputation of being a gold digger before that, and so he knew, and that was like his way of impressing her. He must have known that she would have liked that, because that's otherwise that's just like such a weird out of pocket thing to do on like a first date.
So basically, now we're thinking maybe he planned this whole fucking affair.
So he can't
a new listen, revelation.
He can be smart. He's just dumb about it when it comes to money and his business. He puts all his scheming just into getting mistresses is the lesson that we're taking from this.
I think so. I think like I've newly realized how evil he is, and now I don't like him at all.
The sound of money. The lovely sound of money. I find it quite appealing. A feeling you may share. It seems to cheer me whenever it is near me. It elevates my spirit to hear it in the air.
what savage splendor that made him call of legal tender, as dollars meet in sweet surrender, and as the romance ends.
Dividend. He also like knew that he was going to be a terrible person, you know, because he turned down Ruthie's money. And also his mom knew he was going to be a terrible yeah. person.
That
and
was I the
really
best part.
Wasn't expecting that. I thought she would have a little more faith in him because he is such a mama's boy and he's so good to her.
Yeah. She was like, I will take your presents, but you are a trash person. No, but I was going to say, like, so there's a song, Mama, 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 where it's kind of like a montage song of like him just bringing her different gifts and basically also being like, no woman is ever going to be as good enough for me as you are. And like just sucking up to her a lot. And I think she does in the middle say like, hey, isn't this kind of a lot of gifts? Like, don't you need this money for your business? And he's like, no, I need to treat my mother well. So she's already kind of onto him, I think. Like, she's like, this money's going to go to his head. He's going to become an absolute asshole. Like, I think she knows by then. And then there's a later song where Harry essentially uses Ruthie to like give off the impression that he's like this nice settled down boy who has like a wholesome girlfriend. And that's how he gets his like later business started.
Is it in the family way?
Yeah.
Is that when they... Yeah. So it's when he and Teddy and Meyer meet for dinner at his place and he asks his mom to like cook them the best Jewish meal ever. Because he is kind of the underdog. Like, Teddy and Meyer are already important names in the garment district. Mm-hmm. But he really impresses him because he's really going like the Jackie Kennedy route. And so they literally build this business on family, like on like Jewish friendship so close that they're like, we're family, like we're gonna take care of each other's kids, like we're in it for life.
Yeah.
They really made a big deal to show that like they put a lot of trust into each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then afterwards, Ruthie is going out with him and his mom stops her and she sings a song called Too Soon, which is basically like, listen, I know my son is gonna let this all go to his head. Like, don't give away your heart too soon. Wait a while, see if he's like truly actually serious and committed. And like, Ruthie, I think, brushes her off in that moment. But like, then as we see in Act Two, I think she does catch on.
That's sad, though, when your mom doesn't believe in you.
I mean, to be fair, his mom is like, oh, your father was a good man. Like, I wish you were a little more like him and a little less like me. So I think she was maybe at one point also like that is what she's saying. And she's like, oh, you should be careful because you could end up with no friends. And then he ends up with no
friends. Harry also like, being a good man is what killed my dad.
Yeah. Harry sort of saw that as like a cautionary tale. And he's like, if I'm too nice to people, then I'm going to end up with no money and just people are going to take advantage of me or something. Yeah. So the only way is to take advantage of them. And he has this whole song about he's like, there are pitchers and there are catchers and I'm going to be a pitcher and not a catcher because I want to be in charge of my own life.
Yeah, he's a very Slytherin coded person. Yeah. He really values like being resourceful.
Tedichka, meet Ruthala. Ruthala, meet Tedichka.
Pleased to meet you, Tedichka.
Die, die, digga, digga, die.
Die, die, die. Everyone meet Idala, a mamala of mine.
Time to make the acquaintance. Die, die, digga, digga, die. Die, die, die.
I like this show because it is just, I mean, obviously anti-heroes are kind of a big thing now. And so I enjoyed that, especially from like a golden age type musical. But I think it is also just like a cool look at that time period, the like business sensibilities of that time period, the Jewish life and like, you know, all the restrictions they had, which I didn't really know about.
Yeah, I agree. Like I really enjoy the show. I enjoy that he remains evil because the original ending of like Ruthie and his mom forgiving him and him like admitting to his mistakes, just it feels very forced to me. Yeah. I don't think I would like that. I think there are a lot of really good songs in this show, and it's like kind of weird that it hasn't really seen a bigger revival.
Yeah.
I really like Mama Mama. I really like The Sound of Money. Miss Marmalstein is obviously super famous because of Barbra Streisand. My only critique is just I feel like this flaw in his character of, I feel like they're telling, not showing, that he's a good businessman with ambition. Mm. And yeah, that really ruins the arc for me, because like, if I'm going to root for an anti-hero, I want an evil mastermind.
Yeah, that's fair. Also about the songs, like, I mean, Miss Marmalstein is the most famous song from this, but I think a lot of people do Who Knows in Cabaret, which is Ruthie's song, where she talks about going to shows by herself and stuff. And like, essentially it is painting her out to be a romantic, because she's like, I do all these things by myself because like, there's so much to do in New York as a single girl, but also maybe I'll meet a man here.
I feel like it's a great characterization song for her, because not just for the romantic part, but it's like weirdly modern, and it's kind of ridiculous how, what is it now, 60 years since 1962, this still appears to be a problem, where like, if you are a single woman that takes yourself out to dinner or out to a movie, like yeah, people think you're crazy. And they kind of allude to that, where she's like, yeah, I go to shows by myself, and he's just like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
And so it is like, yeah, she's out to meet someone, but it's also just like, I feel like she seems like a very modern woman. She's like not afraid to put herself out there or meet people or be judged. I feel like at this point we already like her, but it just really like nails that in.
Yeah, it does do a lot of good characterization, and it really paints her as like kind of independent, which also is why it's so satisfying when she dumps him, essentially.
Yeah.
What better way can a single girl with leisure spare time find than to go around, broaden out her background, also improve her mind. Plus, it gives more chances for meeting up with people. When you say, such as certain members of the opposite sex, she hopes to get involved with someday. And who can tell? Who knows? When they might come one's way. Who knows when I'll see him? Who knows? Or why it will be him? Who knows?
They haven't really done a ton of productions about this. It's like not a super well-known show. It also only got mid reviews. Like the reviews were pretty mixed, which I was also surprised by. People
for
were like,
this production?
Yeah. They were like, oh, I yeah, like some of the so rewrites well work, but like we still don't like him, which I'm like, whatever, but that's not the point. It is a very professional production. I think the direction was really great. A lot of the staging was very cool. The set was like simple, but utilized very well. It's a good production.
I feel like a lot of people use that as a criticism. Like, I didn't like the main character. And I think that sometimes is an issue for me, but like in this case just wasn't. I would believe if someone argued like, hey, if Santino wasn't playing it and it was some ugly schmuck, would I like him as much? Maybe like, would I like the show as much? Maybe not. But I don't think it was like, oh, Santino had to play it. Like, I think you just kind of need any reasonably attractive, charismatic, strong male lead.
Yeah. I'm looking at Jesse Green's review. In trying to achieve a balance among its various styles, the musical's book has never solved the problem of being too many things at once: a romance with a heel for a hero, a lovingly Jewish show about a Jew behaving badly, a Broadway comedy with a downer of a message.
Actually, I did see how the original show was described as a romantic comedy. I guess because he ends up with Ruthie at the end, but that is not how I would describe this production of the show. Like, no part of it is it a romantic comedy to me. It's very much how, like, critics were saying Jagged Little Pill was doing too much, and we were like, no, yeah, it wasn't, because it all connects into the same story. I think it's, like, the same thing. It's, like, he's mentioning all these things, and it's, like, honestly, would I call this show trying to be a love story? No, I wouldn't say that. Like, is there a relationship element in it? Yes. Does it add to the bigger plot? Yes. But I don't think it's like trying to be too many things. Like all the things he listed, I feel like just add to the main plot of, you know, Harry Bogan being a bad businessman.
Yeah, I really didn't have that issue. I think part of it is just some people really wanted a main character to relate to, or, you know, it just wasn't what they were expecting based on maybe what they knew about the original show. But I think having come into it with no preconceived notions of it, like, it worked, the plot flowed, I was never really bored by anything. So those were some highlights that we really enjoyed off-Broadway last fall. We will be getting into full swing with the new season of new Broadway musicals, starting with Here Lies Love, which is unfortunately closed by now. But keep an eye out for that episode by subscribing to this podcast on any podcast platform that you prefer. And you can also stay updated on Twitter and Instagram at BottomlessBway, or email us at BottomlessBway@gmail.com. We will be back with Here Lies Love next time.
Miss Marmalstein.
Other girls get called by their nicknames right away. Slightly naughty or risque. Know what I mean? Nobody calls me Hey Coochie
Miss Marmalstein.
Or Bubba
Miss Marmalstein.
Or Passion Pie.
Miss Marmalstein.
Even Hey There Babe, though not respectable. Objectable, it's kind of crummy, but chummy. Course, if I got married, that would do it. So is the lucky guy. Huh? Till then, it still is Miss Marmalstein. Every day I get more and more fuss.
Miss Marmalstein.
Miss Marmalstein.
Miss Marmalstein.
Miss Marmalstein.
Miss Marmalstein.
I could bust.